solid word that I just nailed it. No. No. I turned off all the gas, and then I turned off the pump, and then I turned off the heater. The heater wasn't on, and then I turned off the machine. I'm not sure if I was supposed to do that.
Good morning. This is our sixth class on electrochemistry, and numbers are getting smaller, but people are changing their major to English. I'm going to do a quick review over the last few things that we talked about, and I randomly chose this slide because we talked about mass transport and electrode kinetics, and I think I've beat this to death, possibly. Oh, I have a message. And so we have, that's not the message, okay. So we said a few things about these two topics, but electrode kinetics was the one that we were not going to spend a lot of time with because we don't have a lot of control over it. Mass transport, we're going to spend quite a bit of time on, and we talked about different modes. We talked about migration, which was the bad type of mass transport that we tried to minimize by adding an inert electrolyte, and we don't want that to occur in typical voltammetry. Then we talked about diffusion, which is good, kind of slow, but good, very reproducible, and much electrochemistry is done this way. If you're not in too big of a hurry, then you can use diffusion quite reproducibly to get good precision in analytical chemistry. We use this diagram to describe diffusion and the concept of concentration polarization, where we have a maximum concentration of the species, but at the electrode surface, this is out in the bulk solution, but at the electrode surface, the concentration typically drops to zero, and because the actual electrochemical reaction is occurring of the analyte going to product, in this case by a reduction process. So we polarize the concentrations such that diffusion will then be will occur. And this, again, is the means for mass transport in diffusion-controlled systems. We talked about Fick's laws and or Fickian diffusion, I guess, or whatever you like to call it. And we had Fick's first law, which is steady-state diffusion, and described by this equation. Then we had Fick's... We skipped Fick's second law, I guess. At least in this review we are. And we came up with the Cottrell equation to describe electrochemistry in diffusion-controlled situations. In other words, if I'm measuring current, I, it will be related to these parameters here if it's a diffusion-controlled system, things like the diffusion coefficient, which we talked about, and then time that we allow the diffusion to occur. Concentration is in there. Well, that's a good thing. If we can keep all of these things constant, and typically, of course, electrode area is going to be a constant, and if we have, of course, Faraday's constant is there. Whatever the system is has a certain N. So if we, and of course, that system is also going to have a diffusion coefficient. So basically, in this particular equation, we're going to measure current, and the Cottrell equation will tell us something about the concentration that gives rise to a certain current if we select a particular time in our experiment. And we had a curve for that described or showed what the experiment would look like if we did the a diffusion-controlled experiment. And if we select a particular time, then we can determine the concentration based on the current that we measure at that particular time.
Now, in that term there, that concentration, I read that as C0, which is usually meant, at the beginning or
yes,
the start or something.
Absolutely.
So how is it that... So So is it being used differently then, or is there...
No. What you do is, we had a situation where we looked at the current versus time curve, and from, we'll say, time zero, the curve dropped off. It almost looked like an exponential curve. Okay, so all we're saying is that the Cottrell equation says whatever's happening in the system, okay, I'm going to see this kind of a response. I can select a time t and make a measurement at that time. It can be any time, as long as I make the measurement at that same time. Remember, I said a lot of this analytical measurements we're going to do use a standard. So we measure a standard. We determine the current for the standard at time 5 seconds. Then we get rid of that solution, put in our unknown solution, measure the time at 5 seconds, and it will be related to our standard, and so we can determine concentrations that way. Okay. So it relates back to the initial concentration in this type of a system. Okay, so here is the diagram, and I tried to get across a very basic electrochemical experiment where we have a voltage that does not cause anything to occur in our electrolytic cell. We jump the voltage up to some value that will cause something to occur and hold it there for V versus time, okay, voltage versus time. And our output, our measured current I in that system versus time will look like this. Of course, nothing's happening initially. The minute we reach a voltage where we do cause the electrochemical reaction to occur, the current jumps up and then it drops off because of diffusion, because we have to we use up what's very close to the electrode surface and we have to wait for it to diffuse from further and further away, and so the current continues to drop, and we would see this type of behavior. We then started to talk about convection and what would happen if we stir, and we stir it in the solution and bring material to the electrode surface, and we described the convection situation with the Nernst diffusion layer concept as shown here. And this one is for a stirred solution and a stationary electrode. So I've got an electrode. I actually brought some electrodes today. And so I have an electrode, and I keep the electrode stationary, but I stir out in the bulk solution, bring material very close to the electrode surface. However, there's a stagnant layer right at the electrode surface that has to be dealt with in terms of diffusion. So we call that the Nernst diffusion layer concept. This little layer in here is a stagnant layer which molecules must diffuse across in order to get to the electrode surface. So here's our electrode, and molecules are out here going crazy because of stirring, but they come up to this stagnant layer, and then they diffuse across that layer to get to the electrode surface. And we use this figure to describe that, much like the concentration polarization situation. Again, it's completely analogous, except that we've got stirring out here, convection, stirring, and then diffusion across that layer. They make it look like it's linear, and then to this magic line that we call delta, and then out here it's all uniform. It's a little bit of a simplification, okay, but the math, yes, is there's some kind of a gradient, probably, but that's a little hard to define or to describe mathematically. So they kind of make it look like it's a linear region of diffusion, and that's actually how we deal with it. We just say, in the equation that I showed you, do I have the equation? Yes, I do. In the equation, we just said, oh, it's the bulk minus the surface concentration divided by the thickness, which is linear. It just says, okay, I got some concentration here, I got some concentration at the electrode surface. It might be zero at the electrode surface. We'll just assume there's a perfectly linear gradient across that to that point delta, and after that, it's all completely homogeneous. Well, you know, there's a region in there between that linear, what we're describing as a linear gradient, and the region that is completely homogenized because of stirring, that is probably not as clean a cut as we describe it here. But this equation works out pretty well to describe that type of a situation. So we have another equation without a name describing the current in the system, relating that to the concentration in the bulk solution. It relates it to these parameters. NF, A, D are things that we could get numbers for either from the literature, known things about our system or constants, or known, for example, the electrode area, right? We can actually measure the area of that little disk in the center and determine A in this equation, D for the diffusion coefficient for the species of interest. Faraday we know, and N for the reaction is fine. Delta, we would have to experimentally determine that, which we could do in this situation. If we know N, F, A, and D, we know the concentration and we measure the current, then we could figure out what delta is. But other than that, we don't have any way to figure out or to know delta prior to doing the experiment. But we have a description for stirred systems, and we're going to do some electrochemistry stirred, and we're going to do some electrochemistry diffusion controlled, and both of them will work out for us. We talked about, again, I got back to mass transport and electrode kinetics, and I maybe kind of finished up with this concept of reversibility last class. If the electron transfer process is rapid and we don't have slow kinetics, then that's good. Current then will depend on mass transport, not on how slow the kinetics are. And the surface concentrations will be in equilibrium with the applied potential via the Nernst equation. So the Nernst equation applies here. It applies or it is used in order to determine the applied potential, the potential that we need to apply to the system, the potential that we need to provide to this electrochemical cell in order to cause the electrode reaction to occur, the electrochemical reaction to occur. So we use the Nernst equation to set up our system, and then by the end of class today we'll talk about a system which we can use the Nernst equation to set up and know what the potentials are that we should be applying in order to make the reaction occur. This says if kinetics are fast and we got that mass transport working for us, and that part of it is working fine, then the surface concentrations, the reduced form and the oxidized form, I call them ox and red, and I use that terminology a lot, they are in equilibrium with the applied potential based on the Nernst equation. If all of that is met, if those conditions are met, we use this term reversibility or reversible. The reaction is considered reversible, electrochemically reversible. It's really, all we're saying is it's well-behaved, and it's well-behaved because it is, the kinetics are fast enough to give us good response in our electrochemical system. If the kinetics are slow, and then the response becomes poor, and the system is not well behaved, and we refer to that type of a system as irreversible. And I mentioned reversible versus irreversible. Since it's a kinetic thing, okay, it's dealing with the rates of the reaction, since it's governed by that, then depending on what we do electrochemically, a system could be reversible under one set of conditions and irreversible under another. And the best example of that is if I'm changing the potential, if I'm scanning the potential, and one of the experiments, the little experiment I described for you is an experiment where we change the potential. We start at some potential where nothing is happening, and we scan along until we reach a potential where something is happening, And then we continue to scan, okay, until we, and again, Nernst equation applies because we're crossing potential regions where we might reduce some of the material and there would be an equilibrium concentration of both ox and red. And then we would move gradually across that region into a region where the potential is sufficient to convert all of ox to red. Okay, in that kind of an experiment, if I scan too fast, the kinetics can't keep up. The electrode kinetics can't keep up with the rate at which I'm scanning. And so I begin to have a problem. I begin to outpace the chemistry. My electronics, my ability to change the potential outpaces the ability of the chemical reaction to keep up. The system becomes irreversible, gives me kind of lousy results. And we'll continue to talk about that concept. Process is more likely to be irreversible if there's high current. So I'm trying to jam lots of current in there. I mentioned a rapid potential scan. That's very conceptually easy to understand, I think. It says if process is irreversible, then the rate of reaction at the electrode surface will be slower than predicted for mass transport considerations alone. I set up this kind of a system, vary the potential linearly at a stationary electrode. Ox is going to red. We get this kind of a diagram. I said, this is the reversible case. This is the irreversible case. In the reversible case, no problem. Scanning along, nothing's happening. I begin to see some current being produced from my reduction reaction. It's produced at the cathode because reduction takes place at the cathode. And I'm reducing ox, one electron reduction, to red. And I scan along, and ox begins to be converted to red. And more red is produced, and more and more ox is being converted to red. And I'm crossing this Nernstian controlled region, this region where out here nothing happens. Okay, it's boring. We haven't reached a potential sufficient to cause the reaction to occur. So that's what's going on out here. This whole region in here is the Nernst region, I guess I would call it. Okay, where we're getting different amounts of current due to where we are in terms of the Nernst equation and the potential. Now, if it's diffusion controlled, we're going to have to wait. The diffusion is going to be sort of intertwined with the Nernst equation, and so I guess Cottrell is involved as well. And then we get out to a region where we've satisfied the Nernst equation. There's plenty of potential, and the curve kind of levels off, and we'll see later on it's actually going to drop down and do something related to the Cottrell equation. I want to contrast that reversible case with the irreversible system here, where the kinetics are slow and my scanning of the potential, we said it was a linear scan, E versus time. You can't read that, can you? Let me... E versus time is my potential scan. Okay, linear scan. So I'm changing this potential linearly with time. If I go too fast, if the slope of that is high and I'm scanning quickly across the region and the kinetics of the reaction are slow in the time frame of the scanning, then what happens is I scan along and I'm scanning too fast for the reaction to keep up. It eventually does the reduction, ox to red, but it should have done it back here, but instead it's waiting, it's taking too long, the kinetics are slow. And I ultimately get current produced, but there's a lag there because I'm scanning too fast. And so I see a very different response. It's much more sloped here in this middle region. There's a greater slope. I may not get quite the same current, or at least it'll take me longer to get that current. And we defined the term the over voltage or the over potential. Yes.
So will the two lines eventually hit the same height, theoretically?
Well, what I said to you about the over potential is it's the extra potential that you have to put in to get the same current that you would get in a reversible case. So yeah, ultimately.
Yeah.
But it may take a while.
Okay.
So we got this lag in here. You say, is it a lag in time? Well, it is, even though we're plotting potential, because potential is being varied linearly with time. So it's time and potential co-varying, and that's giving us this lag here. Okay, so let's see, what else do we have? I don't know if I showed you the slide last time. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Over potential, over voltage, potential to achieve the same process. So I think I did. I defined that for the over voltage. I said large over voltage, the process is more irreversible. It's sort of part of the definition. For a reversible process, the over voltage is zero. Okay, yeah, there is no over voltage. Things are behaving the way they should. I have five overvoltage characteristics. I mentioned some of these already, or maybe I mentioned all of them. It increases with current density. So if I have high currents that I'm trying to jam into this electrode, through this electrode, I will tend to slow the process down, or it'll take longer for it to respond. So overvoltage increases with current density, higher current per area, higher amount of current going through this little area of my electrode is going to cause me to have a greater overpotential, overvoltage in my system. If I decrease the temperature, if I increase the temperature, this says increase, so let me say what the slide says. If I increase the temperature, I speed up the kinetics, that decreases the overvoltage. That brings the irreversible case closer to the reversible case just because of a increase in temperature, more rapid kinetics. It's simple, whether you're talking electrodes or molecules in solution, the same process occurs. Overvoltage is high for reactions producing gases or things that have gaseous products. And you could probably rationalize that strictly based on the ability of a gas molecule. We're having a phase change, okay? There's a phase change going on here because we're taking maybe something that's in solution, like a hydrogen ion, and we're reducing it to hydrogen gas. And the hydrogen gas is going to undergo a phase change. It's going to become a gas bubble, okay, and degas from the system. And this process, when we start to deal with gases, it makes the kinetics even worse. And so we end up with higher overvoltages in cases where we have gaseous materials, gaseous products in particular. I mentioned earlier that overvoltage and many of the things that go on in electrochemistry have to do with the electrode composition. I brought in some different electrodes today. This one, let's see. This one is platinum. I don't have a gold electrode. I couldn't find a gold electrode. But this one is platinum. You have to just take my word for it. And this electrode actually, now don't unscrew it. It goes to a rotating electrode system. And it's a big piece of Teflon with a little tiny platinum disc. Okay, and so platinum, although I can't predict for you why exactly with a chemical reaction, draw you an equation, platinum, which you can look at, reacts differently than if I were to make an electrode out of, this is a glassy carbon electrode. How do I know that? It looks like black glass. I should have brought a magnifying glass. You can look at it up close. But it's very shiny, and it's black, and it is. I'll talk a little bit later about the electrode materials, but they take carbon and they put it in glass and make an electrode out of it. Well, platinum and carbon are different. I probably didn't have to tell you that. And they react differently. And so the overvoltage is going to depend somewhat on the ability of the electrode to conduct the chemical reaction, to provide electrons in the case of a reduction, or to act as a sink for electrons in the case of oxidation. So something about the electrode, but can I tell you what about the electrode? I can't specify it exactly other than to say they're different. I'm going to get a different response. I'm going to get a different overvoltage depending on what the electrode material is. Go one step further than that. Number five up here on the slide says it's kind of difficult to specify exactly, but the electrode surface is going to influence the overvoltage in an irreversible reaction as well. And I mentioned to you before, if I take the electrode, this is another glassy carbon electrode. This one's bigger. Okay? This one's bigger. A little less sleek. But if I take this electrode and polish it with very fine polishing materials, and actually electrochemists will put this on a rotator and they'll put polishing materials varying, you know, alumina, for example, and they'll use different size alumina, and they'll use some coarse material first to grind it down a little bit, and then they'll go to more finer materials, and they'll polish this electrode until it's nice and shiny. Okay, so shiny that you can almost see yourself in here. And then you take that electrode and you may chemically treat it. Okay, you might put it in concentrated hydrochloric acid for a few minutes. Or if they're worried that it's dirty after the polishing process, you know, they got it nice and smooth, but there may be chemical species adsorbed to it. Maybe we stick it in base for a while, hydrolyze the surface, okay? And stick it in acid, okay? So we've got a physical treatment, then we've got a chemical treatment, and then last of all, they may hook it up to their potentiostat, which is a different device than we talked about before, and that applies a voltage to the system, and they may electrolyze the electrode in a solution just to prepare it for the experiment that they're going to do. So all of those things that I talked about, the physical polishing, the chemical treatment, the electrochemical electrolysis, is all going to affect the electrode surface. Okay, it's going to affect right down to the molecular, to the atoms that are on the surface of the electrode. It may take, if it's a platinum electrode, you'd expect platinum atoms. But actually, if you looked at it under some surface technique like X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, you'd find out that there's lots of oxygen there. Even though platinum is not prone to oxidation like iron is, and things rust, okay? Platinum doesn't oxidize and corrode like iron does because it's not an active metal, but it does get an oxide layer that forms on it. Well, the electrode's going to be different and respond differently if it's bare platinum atoms at the surface or platinum oxide at the surface, okay? And so you can imagine that what we do to the electrode is going to influence a little bit this concept of overvoltage coming from an irreversible type of reaction. All right. That's my quickie review of what we talked about. It wasn't that quick. It took me half an hour. Now I got to talk about, and now we got to break some new ground here. We've been talking about sort of electrochemistry fundamentals, and so I've got some other electrochemistry fundamentals that I got to tell you about before we can do real electrochemistry, before we can really get down to doing an experiment. There are a couple of kinds of current. I've been talking about current, and I use the symbol I. Sometimes I use a lowercase, sometimes I use a capital I. But current, there are two kinds of current. The current that we're interested in is Faradaic current. Faraday was a big electrochemistry guy, and so he was real ugly, though, really ugly. But at any rate, Faraday, they named the current after him, okay? It's the current due to the electron transfer. And, you know, he was doing experiments in that regard, and he determined basically the charge on a mole of electrons. And so they named the current, the good current, the current that when I'm converting iron 3 to iron 2, I've used that several times, and it takes one electron to do that, and if I have a mole of iron 3 that I want to convert to iron 2, you know, he figured out how many electrons that is and what the charge on it. We know how many electrons. Avogadro, I guess, figured out how many electrons it is, but Faraday figured out the charge on that. Well, that's the kind of Faradaic current that we've been thinking about and we've been talking about, the current to actually do the electrochemical conversion that we're interested in. There's another kind of current. Remember that this is current from the dark side, I guess. This is the bad current, capacitive current. Faradaic current is the good current. This is the stuff that we want. Capacitive current is the bad current, naughty current. And it's the current that flows when you apply a potential to the electrode and the electrode charges up. Now, I drew some little diagrams here for you. Charging like a capacitor. Now, to me, electronics, I don't know, when I was an undergraduate, I took a lot of physics classes and minored in physics and electronics, and it all makes a lot of sense to me. So I use those kinds of analogies, but don't let that throw you off. I talk about a capacitor charging up. You know, a capacitor, the symbol for a capacitor is two plates separated by a non-conductive layer. And if you apply voltage to that, you can store electricity in a capacitor. Well, and then if you touch it with your finger, it zaps you, okay, because that stored electricity will discharge. And an electrode does the same thing. You apply a voltage to an electrochemical cell, the electrodes, both of them, they're polarized. One's positively charged and one's negatively charged because of the voltage that you're applying. You know, picture a battery, right, with some wires going to the two electrodes dipped into the solution. In the solution has to have ions in it, has to be conductive for the whole thing to work. And when we apply the voltage, one of those electrodes has a positive voltage, is a positive terminal, and the other one is negative. And what happens is the positively charged electrode builds up positive charge at the surface, and negative ions migrate. Remember the whole migration business? Okay, we don't like migration, but it happens. And negatively charged ions migrate to the surface of that positively charged electrode to counteract the charge. Remember, migration is still occurring. How did we get rid of it? We don't want our analyte ions, the things that we're interested in measuring, to migrate. We want them to either diffuse or to be pushed around by convection, but we don't want them to be moving under migration. We can't predict that very well. So what we did was we threw in inert electrolyte. We threw in a whole bunch of other ions. So I said, if you throw in a 100-fold excess, then you get 99% of the inert ions migrating and only 1% of the analyte ions migrating, and that's okay. I can live with that. So ions are still migrating. If I apply a positive charge to this electrode, negative ions are going to line themselves up at the surface and create that capacitive effect, okay? That effect where we've got a separation of charge, okay? And while that migration is occurring, it registers as a current. I actually see current flow in the system because of this movement of ions related to this charging of the electrode. Likewise, a negatively charged electrode has little negative charges, okay, and positive ions are lining up there. If I change the potential of the electrode, if I go from a little bit of a positive charge to a big positive charge, then I get more flow of electrons it's negatively charged particles, but negatively charged species. There is such a thing as a solvated electron, but that's a tangent. So negatively charged ions migrate to the positively charged electrode, more of it occurs with the greater potential. All of that creates this capacitive current, but capacitive current doesn't get me anywhere. It just happens because I'm charging up the electrodes as I apply a potential. So capacitive current is an error, is a non-ideal current, is a problem for me. And I'll tell you this right now. I mentioned to you there's about, we're going to talk about probably 14, I think I counted, 14 different electrochemical techniques, voltammetric type techniques. Well, why are there 14 techniques? Why couldn't we just pick one? Okay? Because electrochemists have spent the last, 100 years trying to overcome the measurement, trying to be able to measure Faradaic current in the presence of capacitive current. See, when I do the experiment, I just measure current. And I don't know what percentage of the current comes from the capacitive effect that I'm applying a potential, and maybe I'm changing the potential, and I've got migration going on and capacitive current flowing in my system. I don't know what percentage of it is capacitive current and what percentage of it is Faradaic current. So what electrochemists have done is they've tried to come up with different methods, techniques, tricky electrochemical procedures to separate the two currents. All we care about is the Faradaic current, the current due to the actual electron transfer that we're interested in, and when we don't want capacitive current. So they've developed these different techniques, and we'll talk about those and describe those. But like I said, the last 100 years, that's what they've been doing, trying to come up with ways of getting around this, and that's why we have a lot of different electrochemical techniques. If we change the electrode potential, I mentioned this in a different way, if I increase and make it a higher positive charge or a higher negative charge, current flows to carry the charge to the surface and charge up the electrode. This is capacitive current. The capacitances are significant, 40 to 60 microfarads per square centimeter. You don't need to memorize that number. Okay. We're talking about square centimeter of electrode area. If I got a big electrode area, I'm going to have a much larger capacitive current. If I have a small electrode area, lower capacitive currents. Today, one of the sort of cutting edge areas in electrochemistry is to use microelectrodes, or now they're calling them ultra microelectrodes. Okay? And ultra microelectrodes have several advantages. One of them is because the electrode area is small, then if it's based on electrode area, because it's the area that ions are migrating to create this charging effect, if I have a really small area, then I'm going to have really small capacitances. And therefore, that's one way to minimize the effect of the capacitive current. The problem is, area is in all my equations as directly proportional to current, right? I is equal to NFAD, Cottrell equation, we just talked about it. So that means the greater the area, the greater the current. And the current is the signal. And so if I've got a low signal or I want a big signal to be able to measure the species of interest, the more area I have, the greater the signal. So I increase the area, but that increases the capacitive current. So I got a trade-off. There's always trade-offs in science. There's always trade-offs. There's trade-offs in life. But we don't want to get too philosophical here. So we have a trade-off with greater area gives me greater current. That's good, but it gives me greater capacitive current. That's bad. And so I've got to deal with it. Okay, I got to build a bridge and get over it. Okay, so in methods involving potential scan, capacitive current is the major source of background. So we're always worried about signal versus background in analytical chemistry. The signal, the Faradaic signal, is intertwined with a background of capacitive current, and my detection limit occurs at the concentration. So if I have a system set up to do electrochemistry, analytical electrochemistry, or electroanalytical chemistry, I want to measure some species by an electrochemical technique, the detection limit that I get is going to occur where I can't distinguish the difference between the Faradaic current and the capacitive current. Okay, I've called it I capacitive here. Okay, so I could call this I Faradaic. when I can't distinguish the Faradaic current from the capacitive current, I hit my detection limit. I can't I don't know whether it's noise or capacitive current or whether I'm actually measuring the species of interest. I see a current, but some large portion of that current is due to this capacitive thing. It doesn't have anything to do with the analyte. Okay, so that's a problem. Let me talk to you about potentials. Now that's currents. Now we're going to talk about potentials. There's some potentials that we have to worry about. We've already talked about junction potentials, all right? A potential that develops at the interface between dissimilar solutions. I said that's the most significant. So we have a reference electrode. It has a filling solution in it. I have a test solution. There's a contact between them. There's a junction potential. I think I probably slipped in there that there's junction potentials at every junction. The biggie is the dissimilar solutions. When I stick a solid electrode into an aqueous solution, there's a junction there too. There's a junction between the solution and the electrode. There's a junction potential there, but it's pretty small. It's so small we ignore it, generally speaking. But there are junction potentials. There's another very important potential, and that's the potential due to IR drop. I wish there was a cool name for it, you know, like junction potential. We could call it the IR potential. I don't know. IR for IR. Well, anyway, wherever we have a current flowing through a resistance, remember, is that Ohm's law? I guess that's Ohm's law, yeah. Kirchhoff's law is when you do circuit diagrams or circuit analysis. But this is Ohm's law. Voltage, we get a voltage when we have a current flowing through a resistance. That's what IR is, right? I is my current. Resistance is the resistance to the current flowing through my circuit. And a voltage is produced. Just because current is flowing through a resistance, just because the current is flowing through my electrochemical cell, a voltage is produced by that process, okay? And we get that from basic electronics or basic circuit diagrams. So I have a potential that's there, like the junction potential, that doesn't have anything to do with the E and E0 from the Nernst equation and all of that. So if I want to measure accurately, now remember, in potentiometry, this was not a problem because we really minimized the current flowing in the system. How do we do that? We made R hugomungous, right? We made it we had a meter that had a 100, what was it, greater than 100 mega ohm resistance. So R was huge. There was very little I flowing then. And so any voltage that was caused by current flowing through a resistance was not even there. And so we fixed the system so that we could measure voltages that only had to do with the Nernst equation. Now we're in voltammetric systems. We're not doing potentiometry anymore. We're really trying to convert the species, one species to another. Current is flowing through the system, and because the system has some resistance, I get a potential that's a non-ideal potential that develops in my system. Okay? We can handle this in three ways. Handle it. Deal with it. Okay? We can work at really low currents. Now, trade-off time again. Okay? Trade-off time. If I work at low currents, but current's my signal, who likes to work at low signals? When I want to see something, I want to measure a big signal. So, you know, this is a bad thing. If I, you know, I can, there's only so much I can measure. If I get too low, I'm not going to be able to measure it. So I've got to work in low currents, but not too low so that it creates a problem for me in terms of noise and high variability in the signal. So I can work at low currents. The idea, I guess, probably is to avoid very high currents. Avoid a system. I don't want to work in molar concentrations. I'm going to be working at millimolar, micromolar concentrations, and that's going to give me smaller currents, and so that's going to minimize I in the system, right? That's going to minimize the I, and that'll help me out. That'll minimize V, since the resistance is probably fixed in my electrochemical cell. Number two, I can minimize R. Well, trade-off time again. I add a supporting electrolyte. No, actually, this one isn't really a trade-off, because I have to add the supporting electrolyte in order to minimize migration. Now I'll just add lots of supporting electrolyte. The more electrolyte I add, the greater the conductivity of the solution. Conductivity and resistance are in the inverse of one another. And so by adding more electrolyte to the system, I decrease R. If I'm decreasing R in my little equation over here, then I'm going to decrease V. So that's good. That's a good thing. So I work at low currents. I can work with a larger amount of supporting electrolyte, inert electrolyte in my system, and that's going to help me. And then the third thing is, some people have gone to the trouble of correcting for the V that is produced by measuring R, and since we're measuring current anyway, okay, that's usually what we're measuring in our voltammetric system, then I know I've figured out what R is, or I've measured R, so therefore I can calculate, using these two things, I can calculate V and make a correction for that. It turns out to be kind of hard to do, and too much trouble for most people, so we usually don't do that. But you could, if you wanted to. All right. So we have a problem with potential that comes about due to an IR drop. We can take care of it primarily by these two means. Work at kind of lower currents and put lots of a supporting electrolyte in there to minimize R, increase the conductivity, and therefore minimizing the V based on Ohm's law. All right? Moving right along, if there are kinds of current and kinds of potentials, there are kinds of electrodes. Now, you say, oh yeah, we already talked about two kinds. I'll talk about that in a minute when I talk about electrode materials. What I'm talking about here is ways in which we use the electrode as a stationary electrode, we talked about hydrodynamic electrochemistry before, rotating or vibrating the electrode. The third one I didn't talk about was, I talked about rotating, and those electrodes, these actually go into a rotator. You know, a couple $1,000 unit, which is a high precision motor, and spins at, you know, 1,000 RPMs. But you can select the speed at which you rotate, and it rotates it and creates that convective mass transport that I talked about, and that's a good way to do electrochemistry. Expensive, but a good way to do it. So that's a hydrodynamic, a rotating electrode. We can also use a vibrating wire. Why anybody would do that, I don't know. Probably just to get a PhD thesis out of it or something. But at any rate, and then a wall jet electrode, where you keep the electrode stationary, but you sandblast the electrode with a jet of the solution. And those are used for things if you were going to do HPLC, for example. That's a reasonable configuration to have the effluent come out of the end of the HPLC. It still has some reasonable pressure. You impinge that right on the surface of an electrode. It does the same thing as the rotating. It has the same effect. It's impinging on the electrode, and then it's spreading out over the surface of the electrode, over the face of the electrode. And the equations that describe rotating electrodes and wall jet electrodes are actually similar to each other. So those are hydrodynamic cases. We're going to deal conceptually with the electrochemistry, so I'm not going to worry about too much about the hydrodynamics. I'm going to worry about stationary electrodes for the most part. But then there's this little thing sandwiched in between called a self-renewing electrode. There's two of them. But really, mercury is the only practical one. Apparently, you can also do this with gallium at slightly elevated temperature. I saw one paper on that. It's one of those obscure things, another PhD thesis. But a self-renewing electrode, mercury is a liquid, of course, but it's conductive, it's metal, and it turns out to be a really good surface for electrochemistry. Think about this. All that stuff I said to you about electrode surfaces looking like the surface of the moon, you know, you polish and polish and polish and you chemically treat them and all that stuff, and you look at them under electron microscope and they're still gouges and crevices and cracks and imperfections in the surface of that electrode, even though to the naked eye it looks shiny and smooth and great. If you take a liquid metal like mercury, it's not going to have all that. It's not going to have the surface of the moon. It's not going to have craters and cracks and fissures and so forth. It's going to be a very smooth surface. Okay? So as far as smoothness is concerned, you couldn't get a smoother metallic surface than a liquid like mercury. And so for that reason alone, mercury has some advantages. From the oxidation, purity. If I purify a whole bunch of mercury, you know how you purify mercury? You have to distill it. It's ugly. Let me tell you, it's ugly. And usually we triple distill it when we distill mercury in order to get it really high purity. But I use that mercury for an experiment. Oh, it's dirty now. It's got some impurities in it. Maybe attached to the surface, adsorbed into the mercury. Maybe I reduce lead from lead 2 plus to lead metal, and it amalgamates with the mercury, forms a solution with mercury. So what do? Well, I just throw it away and get some more mercury. So I make myself an electrode, a self-renewing electrode, that has a big reservoir of mercury in it, and it just continuously supplies mercury to my electrochemical experiment. And the old mercury, the dirty mercury that's been used, I just, you know, chuck that away. Now, you don't chuck mercury away. You first of all, because the EPA would be after you. But second of all, because it's expensive and you can send it out now. We don't have a mercury still set up in this building. You can rest at ease. Okay. But when I did my graduate work at the University of New Hampshire, we had a room with a mercury still in it. And we triple distilled the mercury. Well, you can send it out now and have it dry cleaned. Well, it's not dry cleaned. They distill it. You send it to a company called Bethlehem Apparatus, and they clean your mercury and send it back to you. Okay, they distill the mercury. And so we have a steel pig, call it a steel pig, down in the lab, and it's just a steel bottle, and you unscrew the cap, you need a wrench, and you pour mercury into it until it gets to be about, you know, 100 pounds, and then you ship it off to Bethlehem Apparatus, and they send it back to you, purified, distilled in little bottles. Okay, so there is this thing called a dropping mercury electrode, and we'll talk about that later on. There's techniques that are based solely on the dropping mercury electrode. You can use a mercury electrode as a stationary electrode without dropping it, without throwing away the drops, and we'll talk about that as well. But these are different kinds of electrodes. Then there's electrode materials. That's where we get back to the platinum that I passed around. Here's another, you know, glassy carbon, bigger glassy carbon electrode. Here's another platinum electrode. I brought one in before, and this one is nowhere near as shiny as the other one. But that's a platinum electrode. And this is a graphite electrode. And if you're writing with a graphite electrode.
Right.
Yes.
This is a whole carbon streak, right?
Yes, but it's glassy carbon. It's like glass. You can see from the other end that it breaks like glass. But you could take notes with this electrode. Okay. So that's a piece of carbon, graphite, used as an electrode. Now, what they do with the graphite, where'd they get the electrochemists are real cheapos. That's why I like them. So what they do is they make stuff out of... This is probably going to make my hands go all black. They went to the guy down the hall who was doing spectroscopy, and they said, hey, you got one of those big arc spark spectrometers with a big graphite electrode in it? And he said, yeah, can I have one of those electrodes? And so they borrowed the electrode from the guy doing spectroscopy, and they went back to the laboratory, and they made an electrochemical cell and used the graphite electrode. They stuck the electrode into the solution, and they said, wow, this works great. You wouldn't expect it to, but it does. It works great. It actually conducts electricity. It doesn't have to conduct a lot of electricity to do our experiment. and we can get the electrochemical reaction to occur, and everything's fine, except for some problems. Everything's not really fine. First of all, the electrochemistry occurs at everywhere the solution touches the electrode. But all those other electrodes had just a little disc of material sticking out the bottom. Well, that's a better way because the area of the electrode can be determined. If I stick this into a solution, I don't know what the area is exactly. So then they said, all right, we'll stick the electrode into some kind of a sleeve. This is not really the sleeve. But we'll stick it into some kind of a sleeve like those are, and we'll just let the end of it stick out. Okay. Another problem. When they stuck the graphite into the solution, graphite is porous, and the solution begins to seep up into the pores. Now we've got things going on inside the pores, and the area of the electrode again is unknown, and it kind of poisons the electrode or dirties up the electrode, and we can't reproducibly get the electrochemical experiment to work. So we've got to impregnate the pores with something that will keep the water or the solution out. So they dip them in wax. And so it doesn't say any of this here. I'm just telling you. So you take the electrode and you put it in wax and you let the wax soak in. And then you pull it out of the hot wax and let it harden. And then you cut this end off and expose a nice clean surface of graphite. But it's impregnated with wax so that solution can't get up inside. And that's called a WIG, a wax impregnated graphite electrode. But at any rate, these are ways in which we use graphite. So I've got down here the most common materials are mercury, which we talked about. I didn't hand any mercury around because you're not supposed to do that anymore. When I was a kid, we used to play with it, you know. There's nothing wrong with me. But at any rate, the mercury, yes. Well, then I said you cut the end off.
But
so it's all covered.
Doesn't it seep into the bottom?
Excuse me?
Bottom?
Well, you've impregnated. In other words, when I put it in the hot wax, and sometimes they'll actually do this under vacuum, so they'll put the system under a vacuum, they'll impregnate, they'll put it in contact with paraffin wax, melted paraffin wax, and the wax will go right into the pores of the electrode. So the whole electrode is saturated with wax. Okay, you let that wax harden, but now it's still continuous graphite from top to bottom. It's just you've plugged up the pores. You break the end off or cut the end off, exposes a nice clean surface of graphite. You then go about polishing it and cleaning it up. But no, the wax is soaked in. The wax has impregnated the entire thickness of the electrode. So it's all waxed up. It's all gummed up. And then I can connect a little alligator clip to the top to give me electrical contact. And now I've got a WIG, a wax impregnated graphite electrode. So we do mercury, we do platinum, we do gold, we do carbon, another kind of carbon electrode. When the HPLC people came along and said, how about an electrochemical detector for HPLC? They said, yeah, we can do that. And we're real cheapskates. Give me $5 and I'll have you an electrode by noon, you know. So they take a piece of plastic and they drill a hole in it. And they take some graphite powder that they got from grinding up the electrode that they borrowed from the guy down the hall. And they make graphite powder. And then they mix the graphite powder with an oil like Nujol. Where'd they get that? From the guy who's doing IR, because he's making Nujol mulls. And so they said, hey, can I borrow a cup of Nujol? And he gets a cup of Nujol and a little bit of graphite powder, and they mix them together, and they make a carbon paste. And they take the piece of plastic that had the hole drilled in it, and they press the carbon paste in there. On the back side, they connect a wire to it, and they use that as a detector, as an electrode for HPLC. The piece of plastic they machine such that you can have the effluent from your HPLC column flowing over this electrode, and the first electrodes for HPLC, electrochemical detection in HPLC, cost nothing to make because we borrowed all the materials and we have no intention of returning anything we borrow. And on top of that, you can now buy those types of electrodes from a manufacturer for several hundred dollars. But they only cost them a couple dollars to make them. Okay, so all different kinds of graphite, carbon kinds of electrodes that we can make, but it's all the same stuff. And the last one was the glassy carbon, which I assume they take molten glass and dump a bunch of carbon in it and make this black conductive glass that we call glassy carbon. At any rate, here we're going to talk about the chemistry. So I got an electrode material not easily oxidized or reduced. These are some of the materials that we use. We can use other things. We could use copper or iron or something like that, but they're really easily oxidized. And so if I were to go to oxidizing potentials, the electrode itself is going to oxidize. Now, truth of the matter is, everything will oxidize at some potential. So all of these electrodes will oxidize, but the key is the available potential range. In other words, I want to be able to use the electrode over some potential range. Outside that range, okay, if the electrode oxidizes, okay, it oxidizes. And all electrodes will oxidize. If I have a problem on the reducing end of the scale, I got a problem. As long as I've got a window that I can use where I can see some electrochemical reactions occurring that I want to do electrochemistry on, then I'll be fine. So the available potential range is limited not just by the electrode itself, but also by the solvent system. And so here it says the maximum cathodic potential limit, actually it says the maximum cathodic potential is limited by the reduction of the solvent. In other words, if I'm going on the reducing end, we don't have a problem with the electrode reducing. You can't reduce a metal any more than metal. Okay? We can't add electrons to platinum to make platinum minus. So what we do is if we had copper ion, we can convert that to copper metal. But once we get to on the reducing end, we can't reduce the electrode anymore. But we could reduce the solvent. So the reducing end of the scale is limited by the solvent. If water is our solvent, and quite often it is, more electrochemistry is done in water than anything else, although there are other solvents we can use. We can use acetonitrile or other things. But water is the key one. In water, there are protons, little H pluses. And protons, as I told you before, get reduced to hydrogen gas. So whenever I'm using water, I've got a limit. And that limit is the potential at which hydrogen ions are converted to hydrogen gas. Does anybody know what potential that is? Remember the normal hydrogen electrode? Zero. Okay. Now, it's supposed to be zero. But remember that whole deal about the overpotential and the fact that overpotentials are greater when we have gaseous products? It turns out if you do voltammetry, or if you try to reduce hydrogen ions and produce hydrogen gas, you have a large overpotential that puts this somewhere large, meaning a volt, 1 volt. Okay, that's large because we're dealing with millivolts. So on the reducing end of the scale, the overvoltage is so high for the conversion of hydrogen to hydrogen gas that it doesn't happen until 1 volt. It's supposed to happen at zero, but it sounds more impressive, I guess, if I say it's 1,000 millivolts, okay? That's 1 volt. 1,000 millivolts, okay, is the potential at which this typically occurs. Now, I'm throwing round numbers around here. The potential is actually pH dependent. Nernst equation, right? E is equal to E0. The Nernst equation still applies. The problem is we can't predict overvoltages. So we don't know exactly where it's going to come out. I told you that by experiment we found out it's around negative 1 volt. The Nernst equation tells us that the relationship between the hydrogen gas and the hydrogen ion is going to dictate that this is going to occur at a greater or lesser degree depending on what the pH of the system is, right? So if we were to write the Nernst equation for this half reaction, we would write it as a reduction, which it is, and we would put products, hydrogen gas, over reactants, which is hydrogen ion, that have to be squared because there's a 2 in front of it. So there would be partial pressure of hydrogen gas on top, on the far right-hand side of the Nernst equation, where we have that little ratio there of concentrations. We use partial pressures for gases, so it's partial pressure of hydrogen on top. On the bottom, it's the concentration of hydrogen ion, or activity of hydrogen ion, squared. Okay, and n is equal to 2, and so forth, and E0 is 0, but it's pH dependent, so it depends on two things. It depends on the partial pressure of hydrogen, it depends on the hydrogen ion in the system. If initially the partial pressure of hydrogen is very, very low, which it would be, we wouldn't have hydrogen hanging around, we produce the hydrogen by converting an H plus to an H2, two H pluses to an H2, then hydrogen gas partial pressure is very low, but the concentration of the hydrogen ion could be anything. You might have a very acidic solution that you're electrolyzing and creating this. You might have a very basic solution. We could cover a very wide range of hydrogen ions, and that would vary the potential somewhat for the reducing end of my electrochemical scale that is being limited by this reaction. All right? This will become a little bit more obvious as we go along. But electrode materials continued. If I am dealing with things like platinum, gold, and carbon, the anodic end, okay, so that was we just reduced hydrogen ion. That's the cathodic end. That's the right red cat. Reduction takes place at the cathode. So at the reducing end of the system, I have that problem with hydrogen. Not a problem, but that's my limit. On the anodic end, the oxidizing end, if I'm using one of these electrodes, platinum, gold, or carbon, the anodic potential is also limited by the solvent. Okay, so water, if that's my solvent, will also oxidize. Okay, when it oxidizes, now this reaction is written as a reduction. When we oxidize, we're going this way. We're taking water molecules, two of them, and we're losing 4 electrons to produce 4 hydrogen ions and oxygen gas. Now, it's oxidation. It's an anode. It's the anode reaction. So if I'm scanning my potentials, okay, and I didn't write down the potential for this. If I'm scanning along and I'm using these types of electrodes, they're not going to oxidize. The platinum's not going to oxidize. The gold's not going to oxidize. The carbon's not going to oxidize. But the water in my electrochemical cell will oxidize according to this reaction. And I think the potential for this is something around 1.23 volts positive. But I forget. At any rate, so that's a pretty wide range, though. Positive 1.23 volts versus a negative 1. I've got a 2-volt or about a 2,000 millivolt range over which I can do my electrochemistry. Okay, that's okay. For mercury, it is also pH dependent because hydrogen ions in there, and there is an overvoltage because of hydrogen oxygen gas being formed. But we're not going to worry too much about it because it gives us sufficient range on the oxidizing side to do anything we want, basically. On the reducing side, ultimately, we hit a wall where hydrogen ions are being converted to hydrogen gas, and the current for that just keeps going up to the ceiling. Why? Because every hydrogen that we convert to hydrogen gas, the water just auto-dissociates into hydroxide and hydrogen ion and gives us more. We have a continuous supply of hydrogen ions, so we'll never get rid of them. We'll never use up. The same would occur here, but we're not going to have a problem. We're going to have sufficient oxidizing capacity to do all the oxidations that we want. For mercury, the system is not quite as good on the oxidizing end. The maximum anodic potential for mercury is limited by the oxidation of mercury. Well, gee, mercury can oxidize, yeah. Hg can lose an electron and give me Hg plus. Now, in reality, it's Hg2, 2 plus. It exists as a dimer. But we talked about that before when we talked about mercurous chloride, Hg2Cl2. But the point is, mercury can oxidize. So on the reducing end, I got hydrogen. On the other end, I go to oxidizing potentials, and I start to oxidize my electrode. You say, well, when's that going to end? It's going to end when my electrode's gone. Okay? I keep oxidizing and oxidizing and oxidizing, and my electrode is being eaten away. The surface of my electrode is being dissolved as mercury ions, and I just keep getting a huge current that's going to go to the ceiling, maybe to the moon, okay, because I've got loads of mercury there if I'm using a mercury electrode. In the case of mercury, that occurs just slightly positive, around 0 volts. Okay, so I've got a 0 volt problem on the oxidizing end with mercury oxidation. I've got a -1 volt or -1,000 millivolt problem with the reduction of hydrogen. So I've got a 1,000 millivolt range over which I can do electrochemistry with a mercury electrode. I got about a 2,000 millivolt range that I can do electrochemistry with platinum, gold, and carbon. All right. So that's my spiel on electrode materials. I have a little thing. Let's see. Okay. It says here there's a large usable potential range for mercury because of the overvoltage produced by gaseous products on the... I already told you that. That's the whole reason why the hydrogen reduction occurs at -1 instead of 0. Then it says because mercury is a liquid, which has a very smooth surface, it has a particularly high overvoltage for hydrogen reduction. Therefore, it's possible to go to even more cathodic potentials with mercury than it is for platinum, gold, or carbon. So anyway, these are things that you have to think about if you're going to do electrochemical research, I guess. If you were going to do an electrochemical method, you say, oh, I just want to analyze X, and somebody told me I should do it electrochemically. Usually you look up a method, and they say, use this electrode, this solution, these potentials, and you know, you get your result. So you're usually using some kind of a cookbook procedure. So you don't have to worry about these things. I'm telling you the reason why they selected particular electrodes or particular solutions or particular materials in a method that you might employ. The purer the mercury, the higher the overpotential for hydrogen evolution. So we use pure mercury. For carbon, which I have in parentheses is graphite. Graphite electrodes, we impregnate the pores with wax. I mentioned the wig. This keeps solvent from seeping in and changing the electrode surface with time. Carbon paste electrodes are made with Nujol mol, and then glassy carbon is the one that we passed around. So pretty much today, nobody wants to do anything anymore themselves. They just want to call up and order it. So, you know, if you got lots of money, that's great. So people don't typically use these carbon electrodes. They just call up and buy something from some manufacturer. And glassy carbon is probably the electrode of choice, although I guess there are some cases the purists who do electrochemistry say there are some situations where you can't use glassy carbon. It's better to use a graphite electrode. But for the most part, people are just ordering those things, buying them from an electrochemical supplier, and paying exorbitant amounts of money for something that cost them pennies to make. But that's okay. If you got the money. Let's see. What else do we have? Yes. Here comes our first electrochemical technique. Okay? Our first voltammetric falls under the category of voltammetry. I'm going to talk to you about a procedure called electrogravimetry. I guess I changed the slide. It might say on your slide, electrogravimetry controlled potential electrolysis. Electrogravimetry is just a special case of controlled potential electrolysis. Controlled potential electrolysis is the general type of experiment that we're doing. Electrogravimetry is the analytical version of it. Okay, so the analytical version of this is we're going to take two electrodes, put them in solution, apply a potential, and reduce something. What I'm doing on this slide is copper. We're going to reduce a material, a substance, at the cathode and plate it out on that electrode. Since the electrode is getting heavier because we're plating out the metal onto the electrode surface, we can weigh the electrode and find out how much stuff we got. So that's where the gravimetry comes in. So it's a very simple experiment. As a matter of fact, if you have cheap jewelry, it's plated with gold, right? Well, how do they do that? They do it electrochemically. They take the piece of jewelry and they stick it in a gold plating bath and they apply a potential and they plate gold onto some base metal and they sell it to you for, oh, it's pure. Okay? And it's just the same experiment, right? It's the same idea. We take an electrode, we make it the cathode, and we plate out a metal on it. Now, we're going to do it. We're not in the business of making gold jewelry, although we could be. Okay, you might decide. Yeah, it's a good, could be a good business for you. Okay, get a little stand at the mall. Okay, and you could make millions. All right, so what do? It says here, apply a potential to cause a soluble species to reduce or deposit on a solid electrode. So I'm going to take a platinum electrode. We passed one around. And I'm going to stick it in a solution of copper ions. That solution, if it was concentrated, might even be a pretty blue color. Okay, copper ions give you a nice blue color. And we'll talk about charge transfer absorptions later in the semester. But it gives you a blue color. And I make that platinum electrode the cathode. In other words, I apply a negative potential to it that causes the reduction of the copper in solution. Picks up electrons, becomes copper metal. The copper metal plates out onto the platinum, and my platinum turns color from a sort of a gray, white-gray metal, I don't know, silvery-colored metal, whatever color that is, and becomes copper-colored, becomes shiny copper, whatever color that is, that's copper-colored. So I'm plating this material out. If I took the electrode prior to my experiment, and I dried it to constant weight in an oven, okay, cooled it in a desiccator, and weighed it on an analytical balance. To do it correctly, you have to then repeat that step, right? Make sure the weight's the same. You never touch it with your grubby little hands to get oils and things like that on it. And you dry it again and cool it and weigh it again, and it comes out the same weight. We now know it's constant weight. We make that electrode part of an electrochemical cell. I plate out the copper. I'm able to then dry the electrode and weigh it and find out that it's gained weight. Okay, it's on some kind of a diet. Okay, it's on a copper diet. It's gaining weight. And it gained weight because we plated the copper onto the surface. The change in weight of the dried cathode before and after deposition is the amount of copper in the sample. Now, there's two assumptions in this experiment, which are listed here for you. Okay, and they're simple assumptions. The idea is that if I really want to know what was in my solution, okay, plating out some of the copper doesn't cut it because I don't know how much I plated out. Did I plate out 50% or 10%? I got to plate it all out. Okay, so this is the experiment you wanted to do. We're going to just, how long are we going to do it? We're going to do it for time infinity. Okay, all right. We're going to plate until the cows come home, or whatever the expression is you want to use. We're just going to plate it for a long time. And we're going to deplete the whole solution of the copper ions. It's not going to be blue anymore. So it assumes that the copper is plated out. All the copper is plated out. All. And all means all. Okay.
So you're right. Then we'll change the concentration.
Oh, yeah. Change it to zero. Right? It's going to make it from to zero. Then the next assumption is that we're not plating anything else out of the solution. Yes?
If it only plates at the surface, and how do you make sure to scrape off the copper and then go back for more?
No. The copper, when we start out with a platinum electrode, but it becomes a copper electrode. Yes, it'll just keep plating layers and layers on top of the copper, so the copper will just get thicker and thicker.
Okay.
So the cheap jewelry, if we only plate a mono layer of metal on the surface, that'll come off easy. So if you want better jewelry, you better plate many layers on there, okay, for gold-plated jewelry, whatever. Okay, so we're also assuming that nothing else plates out. In other words, if I had in that solution lead, cadmium, zinc, tin, other stuff, and they played out too. Now I've got a copper mixture, you know, something on my electrode that when I weigh it is not pure copper, it's not 100% copper, it's got other stuff in there as well, and now I can't analytically determine what the copper concentration is or the amount of copper. So I've got to do it properly. Well, how do I do that? Well, I select the right potential. I select a potential at which copper plates out and not something else. How do I do that? I use the Nernst equation, of course. All right. So we're going to do a little calculation here. And the calculation says that if I go to my table of standard reduction potentials, I find out that the potential for copper is positive 0.34 volts. Okay, copper goes to copper ion is reduced to copper metal at an E0 of 0.34 volts. At the anode, okay, I've got a copper electrode cathode. I've got a cathode that's plating out copper. What's happening at the anode? What's happening at the anode is that oxidation that we talked about, the oxidation of water. It's written here cut in half, H2O, let's write it this way, half of an oxygen plus two hydrogens and two electrons yields water, okay? But it's really happening as an oxidation at the other electrode. It's written here as a reduction, but it's really an oxidation. And it's 1.23 volts. I guessed that right when I told you before. Okay, so the two things together make up the whole cell. Those are half cells, right? So we put them together, and they're the whole cell. So we flip the oxidation reaction around, and to make it the actual oxidation. And so now it's copper ion and water, and gives us these products. Okay. Now what's that?
So become explosive too.
Explosive? Well, you know, you got hydrogen in there. Sure, you got oxygen in there. Yeah. We're not reducing the hydrogen though to hydrogen gas. We're only getting oxygen, but we could. Okay, so we had previously seen E for the cell type of equation. Well, E for the cell is equal to the E for the copper half cell minus E for the other half cell. And it's actually always that way. If we write these both as reductions, okay, we write them both as reductions, then we plug them in to the Nernst equation, we can write the Nernst equation for each of those half cells. All right? And so E for the cell. Now, a question that might be in your mind is, how do I know which one is which? Okay. Well, what happens is it'll only work one way. Now you can do it. You can set it up the wrong way, and work it out. And by the potential that you get, you'll know that it won't work. Okay, so it'll only work one way. And so we set it up. Now I know in advance that this is the way it's going to be. I know that copper is the reduction and water is the oxidation. But say I didn't know that. Okay, if I didn't know that and I wrote it the wrong way, I put the water on the left and the copper on the right, and worked out worked out the potential, I'd get a potential that would spontaneously occur. Okay, but we know this doesn't occur in this system. If I stick a platinum wire into a copper solution, it doesn't spontaneously produce an electrolytic cell. Excuse me, a galvanic cell. It's an electrolytic system. We have to apply energy in order to make that occur. So, in order to write that out, I use the Nernst equation with these zeros and concentrations. I write out E for the cell from here. In the first set of parentheses, I have the Nernst equation for the copper system to figure out the E for the copper half cell. Minus, in the second set of parentheses, I have the Nernst equation written for the water oxidation. Okay, and put those all together to give me the overall voltage. Now, Nernst equation, E0 minus 0.0591, I left the one off, divided by 2, it's a 2-electron system. LOG, if I'm using 0.059, it's LOG, base 10 logarithm. And it's products over reactants. The product is metal, copper metal. It's that's on top. On the bottom is copper ion concentration. I got to know that. But you say, wait, we were trying to determine the copper in the first place. What I want to do in this system is, when someone hands me a beaker full of copper and says, here's a nice, pretty blue solution, I need you to tell me what the copper concentration is exactly. Okay, I need a very accurate answer. Electrogravimetry is the way to do it, is a way to do it. A legitimate question for you to ask them is, approximately what's the concentration of copper? Is it 1 molar? Is it 0.1 molar? What is it? We plug that number in here. Now, I'll explain why we need to know that in the beginning. But we need to know some approximate idea of what the copper concentration might be. Okay? Then I plug in down here, E0 for the water system, 0.059 over 2, log products. Okay? The product is water. Again, written as a reduction. We set these up written as reductions, so we don't have to worry about which one's the oxidation, which one's the reduction. The water activity of 1, on the left-hand side of the equation, we got partial pressure of oxygen, okay, to the 0.5 power, since I wrote the reaction that way, and hydrogen ion, okay, squared, okay, two H pluses, H plus in brackets squared. So that's my Nernst equation for that half cell. Combine the two things together.